first up, as always, on Tuesdays, we're joined by our friend, writer Colin Fleming, whose latest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, is available wherever fine books are sold. Hello there, Colin.
What's up, our dog?
I saw a picture of you after getting your many steps and sprints and stairs in, and glad to see the hair is, it's beautiful.
Oh, hair pressure. Did I look all right? Did it look svelte?
Yeah. I mean, you looked like a man who's putting in more miles in a week than three quarters of America will put in their lifetime.
The hair, I feel hair pressure sometimes from people. The hair gets very hot. I'm really starting to feel it right now. I'm also using that as a kind of blanket excuse for why I struggled so much running those 10 stairs today after my 10-mile walk out there. But I'm drenched by the time you just, like, walk, even if you're not going that fast. You do it for long enough and it's warm enough, you just start sweating so much. It's, like, unavoidable, even though you're not really, like, you're racing around or anything. But it is, it's quite heavy, this hair. It's hot on the pillow at night. It's gross.
Well, I just got mine buzzed off the first time I've really had it this short in about a year and a half. And, you know, I didn't, because I had the hair for so long, I just got used to it. But boy, when it came off, it was like, I can run higher and jump faster.
The Bruins were in that round robin thing last year when I had my earliest haircut. So Chara was there leading the team. And it's funny, when I go in, and I do get it all shorn away, I'll get the one on the side. You people out there know what the razors mean. And the number three everywhere else. I come out, I go in looking like I'm Chewbacca almost. I come out looking like Alyosha from the Brothers Karamazov. So I'm ready for the monastery when I come out, like the Russian monastery in the 19th century.
Well, speaking of the Bruins, and we're not going to talk about this year's Bruins, but a classic team from 50 years ago, basking in the glow of the previous season's Stanley Cup championship, and hopes were high for those 70-71 Bruins.
We have another Bruins theme of, actually, it's kind of a theme of their history, really, of the missed opportunity, which we touched on last week with the 90-91 Bruins, but I think this was more of a missed opportunity than that particular go-around with the Penguins, because the Bruins were... The Big Bad Bruins thing gets confusing because people think that there was just the Bruins out there throwing the leather aside and letting the fist fly. And this Bruins squad was, a little parallel structure this week, they were the Edmonton Oilers before the Edmonton Oilers, the high-flying Oilers of the 1980s. In fact, the Oilers never did anything like what these Bruins did. It is eye-popping to see no less than seven Bruins in the top nine in scoring in the league. They'd won the cup the year before. They will win the cup as a kind of redemption tour in the year after this. But this was a juggernaut squad unlike anything that had ever been seen in the NHL. And it still might be, even compared to those Oilers teams. 7-9, that's crazy. This was the murderer's row, 1927 Yankees, and whoever else you want to use. This Bruins team, to me, is an all-time offensive team. That 27 Yankees squad, like the 83-84 Edmonton Oilers, and like all of the sports. I don't think it's like a basketball team offensively you can compare to what these Bruins were. And they bowed out in seven in the first round, no less, to the Montreal Canadiens.
Yeah, four guys with 100 points or more. And I had completely forgotten about him because I was pretty young at the time, but I will love those Bruins teams. Fred Stanfield, for goodness sakes, had 76 points.
And that would have put you, because there was like a big, it wasn't like the guy who was ninth in the league had 111 points. Like if you were in the upper 70s, because this was a different era for scoring. It was not like the dead puck era that would come along later on, circa like the turn of the century. But you didn't see, like, 100-point seasons were not the norm. And I still think probably the greatest statistical oddity with that team, the greatest eye-popping number for people who go into the metrics maybe a little bit deeper, is Bobby Orr's plus 124. Because they only played 78 games, too, so you don't have the 82 that you have now. I don't really know how you get to plus 124. You virtually have to be on the ice for, like, hardly any goals against. And you have to be, like, out there for 70%. It seems like it's not quite that high of your team's offensive production. So he had this year for the ages. Phil Esposito leads the team in scoring, and he has an obscene amount of goals with 76. These were just numbers that people, they didn't have. Like, to give you an idea of how quickly the league changed, Gordie Howe, who had been around forever and was in the top five in scoring for a couple decades, he gets close to 40, and he has his only 100-point campaign at the end of the 1960s. So this is a big deal, and they're going to be stonewalled by Ken Dryden, of course. And the thing that's cool about Ken Dryden is that he's not even a rookie. Fascinating to me when you can be the Conn Smythe Trophy winner. It's the playoff MVP, as Dryden would go on to become. And then the next year you win the Calder Trophy as the Rookie of the Year. That's like a pretty neat trick.
This was also a year that saw the return of Teddy Green after one of the most infamous incidents in NHL history, and that blow to the head the year before.
They had a lot of camaraderie going for them, this Bruins squad. You always had the sense that they were tight-knit, and I wonder if maybe they were a little too tight-knit. They enjoyed each other's company perhaps too much. There's something to be said for that, because I think they enjoyed a night on the town. And this team, and we've talked about them this way before, not just this year, but this 1970s Bruins team, they're not even like flirting with being a dynasty. They only win the two cups. And you can't really compare them with the end of the decade 1970s Bruins, because that's a completely, not only a, well, not completely, completely different team, different roster, like Busick is still there, but it's a different aesthetic that's a churning, grind them up, go into the corners, pound people type of team. This was a flowing team. This was more of a Soviet Union 1972 Summit Series type of team, a very elegant kind of team that could also throw the leather as well, too. But it was a very sort of polished group, and I think they were so beloved and lionized and in this, what was becoming a hockey hotbed. It wasn't previously. And all these rinks that you go around Massachusetts now, I go past one a lot of times when I go over to Charlestown, it was built because of this Bruins team. They were just so popular. And I think they basked in that, and it cost them really in terms of their legacy and ultimately their cup counting.
Well, in those late 60s, early 70s Bruins games, always sold out. You couldn't give away tickets to the Celtics, and they were winning championships.
They were winning championships, and I think part of that is because when the Celtics started winning their championships before they get to the end of the 1960s, they're winning them against dubious teams. They're not like the Lakers-Celtics battles and the Celtics-76ers battles of the early and mid-1980s. They're winning them against like a bunch of white guys from like Rochester, and they're dominating those teams. But there was a time when the Bruins were by far the biggest thing going in terms of the major four Boston sports teams. And don't forget, too, this isn't that far off from the 1967 Impossible Dream Red Sox. Right. But they didn't build off of that. They came out and they were ho-hum in 68, and Yaz was doing his thing and had stellar years after that triple crown campaign. And the Patriots were almost like a novelty with the whole AFL, and then they were not what the Patriots. There's a big difference between the Patriots like pre-Brady and then like Brady after. I wonder, like, sometimes people now sort of take this rich tradition for granted because they've only known this tradition. But the Bruins were huge, and people were glued to their sets watching this team too. They really captured the imagination.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown, another team that captured the imagination. And you mentioned them, those mid-80s Edmonton Oilers, the subject of what you think might be the best sports documentary of all time, Boys on the Bus.
I find it a fascinating documentary, even though it is very 1980s. It documents their season, and especially what it is, I'd say more than anything, is a probing of the psyche and the mind of one Wayne Gretzky, who I view as the only sports person I would put in the category of an actual artist. I would put him in the category of a Picasso or a Beethoven or a Dickens or a Proust or whomever else you might want to group him with. And so it's after they've had their disappointment. So it's their redemption tour in documentary style in the 85-86 season. So it's documenting the 86-87 season when they're going to win the cup again after having lost the year before to their rivals, the Calgary Flames, who were just a stacked roster themselves, the Battle of Alberta. And it's that series that people know now, back when GOAT meant a different thing than what it means presently, where Steve Smith, the defenseman, is trying to make a clearing pass out of his own end, and he banks the puck off of Grant Fuhr, his goaltender, and it goes into his own net, an own goal. Now, the thing with that was the Oilers had plenty of time to tie up this game. There was still half of the third period left. And the Flames had taken it to them in that series. That's where they were in that Game 7. And the Flames, I think they probably would have won anyway. But it documents the Oilers trying to get back to the top of the summit. And you see a side of Wayne Gretzky that you would not have seen at the time, for the most part, with his persona. He would make the occasional snippy comment. I remember, like in 1983, he made this infamous remark about the New Jersey Devils franchise when they just torched them, and it was so easy for him to score. He said they were a Mickey Mouse franchise. But that's not exactly like, right, going after somebody in the horrendous ways that we think now when people go after other people. So you get to see a lot of Wayne Gretzky and how he thinks off the ice and how that translates to how he thinks on the ice.
And a mystery to us because he's been so guarded with that public persona. But, you know, even around his teammates, there was still a bit of an air of mystery.
It's difficult. I was thinking about this today. It's difficult being on a hockey team. Now, I don't want to say this the wrong way because there is a lot. I like hockey players, and hockey players are grounded, and they tend to have a reasonable perspective on life, and they enjoy a joke, and they can be witty. But I think it is difficult to be part of a team like that when you have a specific level of an intellectual bent. And that doesn't mean that Gretzky was sitting around translating the novels of Flaubert, but mentally he was on a different level than maybe someone who had a rudimentary education. I don't mean just in terms of where they went to school or even in terms of where they went to school, but might have grown up on a farm and didn't have much curiosity beyond skating at the pond and making it to juniors and trying to make it to the NHL, because Gretzky was on a different level in terms of mental acumen, probity. And so Kevin Lowe was a well-spoken guy, and he narrates this documentary. He shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame, but he narrates this documentary. And he's himself trying to tease out what it is that makes Gretzky tick as he does. And if you go back, and people now talk about, oh, Connor McDavid and Gretzky couldn't do this and the goalies were so small, all of that is true. People are looking at numbers and they're looking at adjusted points and all of that, and I get it. If you go on YouTube, and there are no shortage of games, and you watch the general year, you watch like a Gretzky game, watch like the 87 Canada Cup, I would say that an elite offensive player today averages three near certain or like high chance of success rate scoring opportunities a game, averages that over the 82-game season, shortened season this year. You watch Gretzky play, and he generates 25, 30 high-chance scoring opportunities per game. There's no one like it. Lemieux's not like it. Orr was not like him. Defenseman. It's almost like if Gretzky was playing with other Gretzkys, he would pot like 32 goals per game. It's obscene almost watching him think the game the way he does. And I think that's lost on people now who just like look at clips and look at metrics and don't really think in a nuanced way about anything, let alone sport.
And because of the success they'd had the previous season and because they had the greatest player on the planet, there was also a tremendous amount of pressure on this team. And it's interesting to watch the way they try to avoid that. They deal with it. They ignore it. But it's always there.
They're not getting lost in Edmonton, and I think that's something the film does really well. It gives you a sense that these are almost like local high school Hoosiers type of heroes in this, I don't want to call it a tank town, but like this very blue-collar type of place where it's like, oh, there's Gretzky and Messier, like the Pizza Hut, or whatever it was. And you get this feeling like there are guys. if you lived in Edmonton at the time. And Gretzky was someone who, he fields questions, and Glenn Sather makes a point of saying, I don't know how he doesn't punch these reporters in the face. They ask him the same question all the time, like, what's it like to be such an amazing player? And then, like, cut to Gretzky just studiously answering these guys one after another, never losing his cool, like this ambassador for the game, but just on the ice, this assassin. I think of people who just have, like, something different in their blood that makes them like the athletic version of a killer. Like, David Ortiz would have that. Jordan would have that. And Gretzky sternly, I've never seen anyone else have it to his degree in hockey. So you're getting this, and it's not just Gretzky. This team is stacked. You're like Paul Coffey and Messier. And it's fun to think about Messier now because everyone's like, Tom Wilson is a cat and a villain. It's like, yeah, right. You have no idea. Like, go on YouTube, people. Type in, I haven't done this, I'm just sure there's, like, no shortage of footage. Type in, like, Mark Messier, dirty. And I'm sure you'll see him doing things for which it seems he should have been, like, jailed.
Well, come for the great one, but stay for the Dave Lumley story.
Dave Lumley, yes. And those so-called, like, people who were these protectors of Gretzky. It's another thing you hear now. It's like he had these bodyguards and everything. And I'm not sure if people realize how, because it was such a high scoring era, the 1980s. And I think the highest scoring season was actually 81-82, but it's not like anyone was close to Gretzky. You watch those games, the things you could do to people. And it was like, not only was it not a penalty, it was like fine. It was how you were supposed to play. And if you didn't play that way, you'd have been benched. The amount of stick fouls, it's just funny to me now that when a guy knocks a stick out of another player's hand, that's a penalty, that's slashing. That's crazy to me. It used to be you could do anything you wanted to the player's stick. You just couldn't hold it. But you could wind up from over your head and sever it in half. You know, the sticks were like these like giant logs at the time, these Titan sticks and everything like that Gretzky used, which he said he used because it was heavier, so it helped him control the puck better. But you could do things with your stick to that person's body so long it was below the shoulders. And so it was such a rough and tumble league, but the games were 5-3 every night. So it's not like this, oh, anyone, my grandmother could have gone out there and like averaged the points a game. It was like a different kind of beast. Like you'd get your clock cleaned, and Gretzky did a lot. So that's why, I don't know, he had these guys on the team who, Messier, and he was an elite player, and they all just seemed to challenge each other to go to a different level. They were competitive. They were almost like the Beatles, where it's like, oh, you wrote this and you got the A side, I want the next A side. And you get that sense with Messier. Messier says to Gretzky at one point, like, oh, don't you wish like there was like a puck, there were more pucks, and like everyone had a puck. And Gretzky's like, no, D-bag, the puck is mine. Like, he's so like possessive of the puck, this like all-time assist guy. So you get to see how his creativity works and how he thinks and how he speaks.
From hockey to, I think, a recently discovered live performance from 1968, the San Jose Civic Auditorium, The Who, as good as anybody, live with a local opening act that drew an even bigger crowd, Blue Cheer.
The Who tape has circulated, but it's never been like a well-known one. Those like sort of pre-69 Who bootlegs, you had to work a little bit to find back in the day. Now, of course, you can just go on YouTube. But what's new about this, or fairly new, is like you said, that you get the opening act of Blue Cheer. And Blue Cheer had their big moment, or were going to have their big moment in 1968 with Summertime Blues. I've always been fascinated by Blue Cheer. I think I told you this once. It was like at a mall once, and I saw this cassette tape, Blue Cheer. And it was a compilation. Like, Blue Cheer had like 13 albums that we needed to distill into a compilation. Like, somebody was working to make this cassette tape, and the name of the album was Louder Than God. And I just thought, oh, wow, they must rock. I mean, and it wasn't like something from back in the day. Some like marketing person must have like made it up so they could sell this tape at the Strawberries or whatever it was. But you get these two super loud groups. And this is obviously for The Who. It's pre-Tommy. And they're very exciting, like arty heavy metal or pre-sort of proto-heavy metal band playing these songs that are like have a Pink Floyd artiness to them. Like, Beatles wouldn't have done things like this, even when they sort of went with psychedelia and all that. So then, of course, you have this contrast of Blue Cheer coming on first, and it's a pretty listenable, sound quality-wise tape, and it, to hear the contrasting styles, and you can really imagine that you're having this night out back in the day.
And finally, we've talked about Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, a number of times, but as I was saying earlier in the show, with good reason, and you've called it art, and that is absolutely true. Listening to the five-part Broderick Matter, and there is nothing on premium channels, on cable, anywhere that's any better written or better acted than these Johnny Dollar shows.
And as you pointed out one time, it's like everything, the level of detail and the sound design. I was thinking recently about like Star Wars, and I was watching that new series, The Bad Batch, I think it's called, on the Disney app. And so much of Star Wars, really, the appeal is the sound design. Like, you might not notice it, like, you know, it's like subconsciously, but that's just like really the whole platform for the franchise. And the first film has all these other things going for it, too. I think the others are largely duds, even though I enjoy them and have like the unfiltered, like Hermy editions and all that. But still, it's the sound design. So you have everything going on with these Johnny Dollars, these five-part episodes from 55 and 56 with Bob Bailey as the title character. And this one is, I mean, as a piece of writing, as a work of art, as a work of gripping entertainment, as a course in how to view the life you lead and how people live their own lives and to get better at understanding motive and how people work. And just also, too, because certainly I've had very similar experiences. I had a very similar experience in a marriage, in a way, to what happens in this story. So the gist of the plot is Johnny Dollar is contacted to track down a woman, and she's going to be like, I think he does the math, and she's in her late 20s at the time. And she has $1,500 coming to her as part of someone else's insurance policy. That person died. That person who died was barely a step above homeless, if that. And they died of like heart disease and tuberculosis and all these like horrible things. And you get the sense, it's not said outright. That's how well written it is, but it's in there. As my friend Norberg would say, it's in there, this idea that this guy was somehow like fudging with the insurance company so he could like keep this policy, and he's found dead, and he's leaving this money to this woman who was a girl at the time. She was 11 years old, and his job was to sell newspapers on the street corner. She saw him one day, she helped him, and that was it. He found out who she was, and he wanted to leave her this money. Now, right away, it's like, if you're not hooked by that, that's drama. Like, anyone with a heart or a soul is pulled into this, because this guy has, like, no quality of life. But he's meeting these payments, like, on the exact day every single time. And Dollar cannot track down this woman. He can't find her. And he ends up going through her story. And she does what we would now call ghosting to a lot of people, a lot of guys. You get the feeling she's going through all these different men of different ages and everything. And she's smart. And that's one reason why this deceased person was so taken with her, even when she was a young girl. And Dollar at one point says he's so, like, just beaten down by this. He's ground down by this. He says to the insurance guy, he says, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, it's costing him something of himself to learn all of these things that he's learning. And the insurance guy has to give him like this sort of pep talk to continue on with what really becomes, I call it almost like a mission of the soul.
Yeah. And there are so many great moments when he's talking to one of the older men who she has ghosted. And he says, you know, she might be dead. And the man says, oh, don't even say that word. And his response is great. He says, it's just a word. And say, oh my God, yes, this is where he is. This is where Johnny Dollar has reached in his life of chasing these people all these years.
That man is because he's talked about like his age, a different like sort of descriptors used for it multiple times. He's only like 45 years old.
Right.
And he was with her, and she was like, when he does the math, she's like 27, 28. It's just like not that unusual. I mean, people look differently back then, of course. And so this guy looked like Bob Montgomery for all we know. But she walks out on him like on Christmas Eve, like at a gas station. And the thing about Dollar, too, is Dollar is the most competent by far of any fictional character I know. You're picking up on that now, right?
Oh, God,
like,
yeah.
He is better at his job than Sherlock Holmes is at his. Like,
oh, yeah,
wrong percentage-wise than Holmes.
And when he wants that man to tell him more of the story, because he knows, he just knows there's more, he says, "You're talking to me, not the insurance company."
He projects such certainty. And that line reminds me of like when Lennon and McCartney were having a fight. Lennon at one point would lean in and say, "Paul, it's only me." And it's like he's having that kind of moment, but with the everyman, because he doesn't know this guy intimately like Lennon and McCartney knew each other. But he also does know him intimately at the same time. And he knows that the guy is not, I wouldn't say lying to him, because that puts this kind of like venal edge to it.
Right.
It's not that. It's that the guy himself is hurting. He's not just hurting so much because she's gone. He's hurting because he can't help her.
Yeah.
It's almost like in 1951 Scrooge, when Marley shows up at Scrooge's room, he terrifies him out of his mind. And then Marley's like, "You haven't seen anything yet. I'm going to leave. Watch what I do." And like, cut to that scene in the street where Marley's ghost and all these other ghosts are lamenting, swooning over this homeless woman with her child in the street because they can't intercede. They can't help. And Scrooge shudders and he throws the window shut. That's the scariest moment and the scariest scene of the entire film. So it's very much like that. So it's like a Christmas sort of like work within this overall drama and tragedy. And then the way it, like, I don't know, who could you play this for? Like, if you play this to your kids and all their technology and all that stuff, I mean, like, your kids at school, I feel like they'd be riveted by this. I feel like anybody would. This is, like I said to you before, one of the great discoveries of my life. It's like Tender as the Night by Fitzgerald. It was like Revolver by the Beatles. This is that good, and no one has ever talked about it that way.
No, and I love the ending to it without giving too much away, but when he finally finds the girl, he's trying to help her, and there's a discussion about death, and he admits that he's afraid of it, and then Johnny Dollar says, I don't like to be afraid of anything. I love that line.
And it's the thing, too, because he's so emotionally denuded throughout. Like, you wouldn't say, I've sometimes seen the series, and there were a bunch of other characters, actors rather, playing the Johnny Dollar character. It's like a tough gumshoe. He's not. I mean, he's someone, in many ways, I identify with a lot. I think it's a character that, not to say that I have, like, oh, great amounts of things in common with, but it's someone that I know there aren't a lot of people I can say this about. If I went out with them for a coffee or to run some stairs, we'd be on the same page about a lot of things. In fact, the greatest compliment I can give this character is I have a connection with them. We talked about, like, connection. I've only had, like, I don't know, one, two, whatever connection, like a connection. Connection is sort of like a handshake of the soul. I have that with this character. And the rest of the show, the aesthetic of it all, I also have a connection with that. You can learn so much from this, as it is just entertaining the hell out of you, too.
Yeah, it's The Broderick Matter, five 15-minute episodes. It'll fly by. Of all the episodes I've listened to, I think this might be my favorite, but you can catch them all out there on YouTube. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Colin, thank you as always, my friend. We'll catch you again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming here on Downtown.